Hello, this is Karen Motokaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It at KDRT LP 95.7 FM. And this show is How She Really Does It, where inspiration and possibility meet. And each week I bring on guests, and I carefully vet all my guests that I bring to you that can help inspire, empower, and entertain you so that you can open up the possibilities, the windows of possibilities in your life, and start implementing them. So each week I bring on different topics. It could be about food, it could be nutrition, money, starting your business, relationships, family, education, lots of different topics. And again, the people that I bring on, I've carefully vetted, I've gone through their information and done a lot of research to help you have a better life. So it's about information for you to empower yourself. And this week I have Elise Reach, and she is the co-author of Intuitive Eating, and her philosophy embraces the goal of reconnecting with internal wisdom about eating with which one is born for the purpose of developing a healthy and satisfying relationship with food and body. And please welcome Elise. So Elise, let's talk about first about your background.
Absolutely. I am a registered dietitian and a nutrition therapist. I've been in private practice for almost 30 years. And when I trained to become a dietitian, I trained with children with developmental disabilities. And I just decided that that was the work I was going to do, was helping these kids. And I wasn't going to deal with weight issues, because even in those days, the data were dismal. I didn't want to work with something that seemed to have such a failure rate. But as I started my practice, I got referrals from doctors who wanted to have me help their patients lose weight because of medical problems and other reasons, and I just had to surrender to doing the work. And unfortunately, in those early days, I was helping people in a way I had been trained in graduate school, which mm-hmm. was to put people on meal plans. They weren't actually diets, but they were prescribed meal plans that I would give them. And I would say to them, oh, yes, if you want a cookie, you can have a cookie, but why don't you have the apple instead? You know, it was a goal set at weight loss, and people would follow or not follow. And the ones who would follow the meal plans and do very well would be so excited that they would have lost their weight and tell me I was great because I'd helped them lose weight. And then about a year or two later, they'd come back to me kind of tail between the legs saying, oh, my God, I just, you know, I'm a failure. I couldn't do this. Never blaming me, just blaming themselves. Others couldn't do it to begin with. And all the time I was feeling really bad about the whole idea. It just didn't sit right with me. And most of these people that I work with, I'm really lucky enough to work with some wonderfully intelligent and successful people, but they weren't successful in this area. So after a while, I said, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. And I started really looking into the psychology of eating, looking into the research around toddler eating, and finally coming to a place where I knew that something had to change, and I couldn't give people meal plans anymore. So that's the background of it.
And so then, why don't diets work?
There's so many reasons that diets don't work. First of all, physiologically, what I like to say is you can't fool Mother Nature. We are meant to be a particular set point weight that's genetically determined. So if you put someone on a diet, what you're doing is sending a signal to the brain that this organism is in danger. Do everything that you can to get the person back into something I like to call homeobalance, where everything goes back to the way it was. And so with the brain chemicals, the body sends out signals to slow the metabolism so that you don't need as many calories as you needed before, because after all, if the organism is in danger, you want to preserve life, and so metabolism slows down, so you need to eat less. And of course, if you get off of this plan, your metabolism slowed, and now you're eating regularly or even more, and you gain weight back very quickly. And the brain also sends out chemicals to release hormones and enzymes that are there to promote fat deposition. So physiologically, it doesn't work. And at a neurochemical level, which is so fascinating, and there's so much research about that now, when someone doesn't get in enough calories or carbohydrate, what's released from the brain is a neuropeptide called neuropeptide Y. And what does that neuropeptide do? It sends you out to go seek food, and especially carbohydrates. So you're driven neurochemically, you're driven physiologically to gain the weight back. But that's a, you know, that's a physical part of it. Really, it's much more of a psychological reason the diets don't work. And there's two main components to it. The first part is deprivation. Maslow, who was a psychologist, always said that we are driven by our unmet needs. So what we can't have is what we want. Now, if I had a little child in the room here and I had 47 toys on the ground and I also had the little rock that's in the corner of my office that says intuition and said to that child, you can pick any one of those toys, but you can't play with the rock, you know, where do you think the child will go? To the rock. So it's what you can't have is what you want. And then there's also another part of it. I was also looking into the psychology of how people interact with each other. And when someone is using an authority voice to tell someone else what to do, the other person tends to respond in a teenage rebellious voice. So telling that child he can't have the rock, he wants the rock just because you told him he can't have it. But there's this really powerful component that's something that I've been thinking about for many years, which is that internally we have this very private place that holds, as you said earlier, all the wisdom that we need to have about eating. I believe we're all born with that wisdom. So we know when we're hungry. We know when we're full. We know what we want to eat. And if a diet or someone who's giving you a diet crosses that boundary into that very private area, I think that our first job is to protect our autonomy. So when people are out there trying to lose weight, the major force is to protect the autonomy. No, this is who I am and this is what I want, and you're not going to tell me what to do. Much more power in protecting that autonomy than in needing to lose weight. And any diet is going to tell you what to eat, when to eat, how much to eat, when to stop, and it's just not going to work in the long run. 95 to 98% of people who go on diets gain the weight back, and about 40% of them gain even more weight back. So there's nothing wrong with people. There's something wrong with the system.
And that's a really good point that you made. And so when people, because when people come, when I have weight loss clients that come to me, they expect me to either judge their food journals or tell them which are good foods to eat and which ones are bad foods to eat. And that's not my role. And with you being a dietitian, do people come in expecting you're going to do that too?
Absolutely. You know, they're going to come in with all these preconceived ideas of good foods and bad foods. And actually, my job is to help them understand that once we take away all of those notions and really start tuning in, we're going to end up with a balance of eating. And there's no, emotionally, there's got to be no difference between any food. No food's a good food, no food's a bad food. If we're introduced to a wide variety of foods when we're very young and the palate, you know, knows many foods with free will, with no guilt, with no judgment, we end up with balance. And this is shown in toddler studies, which is, as I said earlier, one of the most powerful reasons behind this whole sense of intuitive eating is toddlers do it. I am so lucky to be working with clients who have had children while they've been working with me. So they're working with me to change their eating and get back to their roots of intuitive eating. And their children are growing up being raised with this philosophy. And some of the most amazing things happen. There was a client of mine who came in when her daughter was 7 months old, and she walked into my office and she threw her arms around me and said, "Thank you for seeing me." She had been referred by her pediatrician. She said, "I have no idea how to feed my child," because this woman had had many years of an eating disorder herself. And we worked together, both helping her and helping her learn how to raise her child. And this little girl is about 6 and a half now, and she's phenomenal. She wakes up in the morning sometimes, and she says, "Mommy, I want hearts of palm and tofu for breakfast." Or if she goes to a restaurant, her family has always let her order herself. She'll order her omelet, and the server will say, "Would you like french fries or a salad with it?" And she orders a salad because she doesn't like potatoes. Now, she eats ice cream and she eats cookies, but she doesn't see any emotional difference between them. So she just eats what she feels like eating. And I'm seeing this with so many children now.
Wow. Yes, what an amazing gift, especially from a mother who, you know, had so many issues with food. to be able to do it differently with your help for her child.
It's exciting for me, extremely.
My daughter, I have an 8-year-old daughter, and she's so funny because we'll sometimes say something about McDonald's, and she's like, I don't like McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and she's like, and I don't like French fries.
That's what she says.
Uh-huh. And French fries are probably like one of my favorite things to eat, and especially McDonald's French fries. But she's like, nope, don't like it. It's not, there's not that emotional of, oh, it's a bad food or it's a food that I can't have.
Exactly. And when you as an adult feel that way, when you get your French fries, mm-hmm. notice whether your 10th French fry tastes as good as the first one. When they start to get cold and soggy, they're not as good. But if you think that you're not supposed to have them and you're not going to let yourself have them next week, you're going to eat all those French fries.
Yeah.
Even if they're not tasting very good anymore.
There were these French fries. I do this tedious food journal exercise with my clients, and I did this before a long time ago with myself. And there were these French fries from this other restaurant, and I said, just love them. And so finally I said, okay, I'm going to go and do this. And I went and I sat down at the restaurant, and I tasted these French fries, and I realized that I never liked the taste.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was just the idea that it was French fries. And for me, French fries have been kind of a forbidden food when I was a child, so the conditioning that I had. And after that, I never wanted to go and eat French fries there again.
I have some French fry stories also that have to do with habituation. When you have too much of something, it doesn't taste as good. I was going to be going to a restaurant on the weekend that had wonderful French fries and was looking forward to it, and ended up at a different restaurant earlier in the week and had French fries that night. And by the time I got to the second restaurant, I could care less.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't exciting. It wasn't an emotionally charged moment. I can have them anytime I want to. So mm-hmm. they've got to be tasting great.
It's not the Last Supper.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
So what's the first step? So we figure. Oh, let me do an introduction. Okay. Elise Resch.
Resch.
Uh-huh. Excuse me. Elise Resch. She's the co-author of Intuitive Eating, and she's on How She Really Does It. And this is Corinne Motokaitis. So Elise, uh-huh. what's the first step? We know diets don't work. Uh-huh. Then what's the first step?
One has to be at that place where she or he realizes that diets are not going to be in the picture ever in the future. You know, someone who has said, I've done it so many times and it doesn't work, I'm sick of it, I can't do it again. Because I find that when people think that there might be another diet in the future, if they take this as, oh, I'll give this a try, I'll see how it goes, just the mere thought of future deprivation, maybe going on a diet at some point, telling them what they can and can't have, it's not going to work for them because they're geared for that. So you have to be at a place, first of all, that says, I will never diet again. And the first piece of it to me is making peace with food, taking away all of that judgment, all of the good and bad foods, all foods are equal, so that you can really go for what I think now, and after all these years of doing this work, I'm looking at satisfaction as the driving force of intuitive eating. If you're moving toward a place where you want satisfaction in your meals, you're going to eat foods that you really want to eat. You're going to eat when you're moderately hungry. We talk about mm-hmm. honoring hunger. I'm sure you've eaten sometime when you weren't hungry. It doesn't taste as good. So mm-hmm. you want to eat when you're moderately hungry, not over hungry. When you're over hungry, then, you know, that's when you eat the whole cow, right? So you're going to choose to eat when you're moderately hungry. You're going to eat the food that you want to eat. You're going to really start to notice that the food's not tasting as good as it did when you started, because when you stay present during the meal, you see the diminishing returns of the food. There's a term called sensory-specific satiety. That's a study of how food tastes over time, and it just doesn't taste as good as time goes on. So you're going to be more likely to stop when the food doesn't taste as good, especially if you know this isn't the last time, as you said, Last Supper eating. It's not going to be the last time you're going to get it, so you might be willing to stop then. So it's going to be more satisfying, because if you keep eating beyond fullness, it's not very satisfying. If you're eating emotionally, it's not very satisfying. So learning how to cope with emotions without using the food, helping you separate the emotions from the eating, or even something as light as, maybe not so light, but who wants to eat when you're in the middle of a fight with someone? So finding ways to eat that are going to give you the most satisfaction. And that's kind of the journey that people go on in different ways. It's not a set plan. It's exploring different aspects of this.
And what I loved so much about your book and your audios were that it's not about an all or nothing. It's really about an exploration of seeing what works, kind of a trial and error, and getting in tune with what works for you.
An all or nothing thinking, dichotomous thinking in any aspect of life is dangerous. It's not going to give you mental health. So, yes, this is, you're not eating it all and never getting it again. You have it whenever you want it.
Now, do you ever have clients that go, okay, I'm just not losing weight fast enough. Can you give me a meal plan?
I have that all the time because people are very, very scared that they don't know. And I'm pretty resistant to that. I'm impossible, in fact. I don't want to give out meal plans because what I'm saying if I give out a meal plan is that I don't trust that you're going to know how to do this. Oh, I might teach people who don't know a lot about nutrition if they ask me questions. I might teach them that if you have a balanced meal with protein, carbohydrate, and fat, you're going to have a more sustaining effect of the meal. It's going to hold you longer. You're going to have more energy. I might help someone think up what would work for him or her, you know, talk about the kind of breakfast that she would like or he would like. But no, I don't ever give out a meal plan.
And when you start to talk about the nutrition component, is that something you can do when you first start out your relationship with them?
Absolutely not. And this is one of the things that I had to deal with very early on in my work when I threw out the idea of diets. Here I have a degree in nutrition, and I'm telling people they can eat anything they want. Oh, no. What's going to happen? So I do trust, though, that over time, when you get past all the psychological barriers that diets have presented to people in the past, what ends up happening is they're going to end up eating in a very balanced way with great nutrition. Of course, part of that, and in raising children, part of that is offering them a wide variety of foods when they're very young so that they have an understanding of what these foods taste like. So I guess if someone has been raised all of her life on Ritz crackers and, you know, ketchup or something, there won't be as much of an orientation toward healthy food. So for some people, the nutrition component does have to be taught, and that would be much later on in the process because early on it will sabotage.
Well, won't they go more into diet mentality?
Absolutely, right back into diet mentality. So I stay away from that completely. And even when I'm teaching nutrition, I think it's very important to recognize that every food that one eats doesn't have to be nutritious. There are foods which I like to call play food. Other people call them junk food. But I think that we all need to have some play in our lives, and so we also need to have that with food. So there's a component of, of fun in eating. And even those kinds of foods have a place in our lives. And I think that a lot of people who are stressing so much about their nutrition and trying to get everything perfectly nutritious and organic, and what they end up doing is they raise their cortisol levels, which is our cortisol stress hormone. And I think that's much more unhealthy than it would be to just eat a candy bar.
Well, do you find, because I know sometimes I have clients who are also skinny, so, you know, why would they come to a weight loss coach? But they may be skinny, and people on the outside may view them that they've got it all together, but they're in constant turmoil, and they don't have this free, like, life where, oh, I can go and travel because then it's going to mess up my diet plan or my regimen.
Yes, they're absolutely terrified. So they're not comfortable. I mean, the fact that their bodies are skinny doesn't make them happy, mm-hmm. really, because they're always afraid of losing that. And, you know, there's a whole new diagnosis in the eating disorder world called orthorexia, where people control their eating based on the health of the food, and they will not touch anything that isn't, say, organic or vegan or whatever they deem to be the healthiest of foods. It becomes a control issue, and these people who are doing that are scared all the time that they're going to either fall off of it or not fall off of it, but accidentally eat something that isn't ultimately the healthiest, and it's going to make them sick. It's really the obsession with it that can make them sick.
And so with this new disease, what's the ramifications? Do they not get enough calories still?
Well, some people end up very underweight with that because they're so rigid that they just don't get enough of what they need. Other people can be normal weight, but it's more of a psychological ramification. Mm-hmm. They're just stressed and obsessing all the time.
And they can't live their life because it's always around food.
Right, and as you just said, they can't go to certain places because this restaurant doesn't serve, you know, a vegan meal, or this restaurant isn't organic, or they can't travel because what are they going to get on an airplane? Or, well, we don't get much on an airplane anymore, but yes, it makes life very rigid.
I knew for me, I had kind of hit a breakthrough at one point when I could go away with a group of girlfriends for the weekend and not be caught up on where we were going to eat and what it was going to be like. Mm-hmm. I was really just like, I can go with the flow. And that was also me changing, because I like to plan. I like to have you know, but me letting go and going, you know what, it will work out. It doesn't have to be the perfect meal.
Well, and it is all about trust, isn't it? I mean, when you come to that place of really understanding that your body is trustworthy, it will give you the messages that you need to have as long as you're not feeling guilty or in judgment or, you know, afraid, then you can go anywhere. It doesn't matter. I had a client yesterday who told me she'd just come back from a fabulous vacation up in Northern California, and she and her husband had gone out to elegant meals every night, and she said it was the first time in her life that she came back and her clothes weren't tight, and they weren't using Alka-Seltzer every night, which is what they usually use. So it doesn't matter where you are or what is presented. You know that you can trust your body to get you through it.
What is the we have a lot of conditioning that goes on from childhood.
Right.
And it goes all the way through, and then you hit the teenage years, you've got media.
Mm-hmm.
What are ways, can you give me an example of how we can change some of that conditioning?
How we can change the conditioning?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying? Well, it starts with getting right down to, is this working for me? Is trying to become the image that I see in media, or lose the weight that the doctor is telling me to lose. And by the way, a lot of people will not go to doctors because they're afraid of being weighed and they don't want to be told that they need to lose weight. Start really examining that it's not working for them, that they're not happy, that they're not feeling safe, that they're not comfortable, that they're emotionally, you know, wrought around this. And finally, just say, I'm, you know, there's a strike. I'm not going to do what people tell me to do, and I'm going to start to learn to trust myself. It's hard. It's not easy. Although this concept, this philosophy is becoming more well known throughout the world, really. And there is a paradigm shift happening, the way that it happens in all social movements. But this is it is hard. You have to come to the place of deciding that you can't do it anymore. And of course, you know, there's all kinds of organizations who are promoting change in the media. And one of the biggest problems, actually, is some of the pediatricians in town who are really, you know, trying very hard to fight against this obesity epidemic. And they're telling parents, you know, watch what your child's eating, make sure the child's losing weight. And the opposite starts to happen. There was a study done a number of years ago of 5-year-old girls who were at risk for overweight, and they followed these girls for 4 years until they were 9. And the girls that were monitored and told what to eat and how much to eat and, you know, essentially put on diets were the ones who were more overweight when they were 9 than the girls who were just left alone. So we do have to educate the medical community as well. We're not fixing obesity by putting people on diets.
Well, and do you get frustrated when you see some of the stuff that comes out on the news or in magazine articles about, you know, these weight loss things that go against intuitive eating?
Well, it makes me very angry. It's this $3 billion a year business with such a dismal, you know, success rate. And it's just a myth that's being perpetuated in society. It makes me very angry. These are money-making people, for the most part, who are coming out with all these different diets. It's very interesting. Intuitive eating came out originally in 1995, so it's been around for 15 years, and it's never been one of those sensationalistic books that, you know, you see on all the talk shows and everybody is running and buying, and then you never hear about it again. It's something that just has been around and is building and building and keeps being reprinted and being used in eating disorder treatment programs and talked about, but it's not sensationalistic because it's bottom line. It's bottom line basic. In fact, I've had some women say to me, my husband thinks that you're running a scam. You're just telling me that I can eat whatever I want, you know, and I'm paying you for that. So, it's pretty funny.
Well, I had a client this morning who said, you know, this is really simple. And just changing some of the basic concepts or learning to be, one of the things that we're working on is her being more compassionate with herself.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's such a simple concept, but it takes so much practice.
Well, compassion, and I'm glad you brought that up, the compassion part is absolutely fundamental. I would say that the majority of people who walk in my office feel guilty about what they're eating. And we have to take the morality out of eating. And in fact, I say to my clients often, the only time that you can feel guilty about what you're eating is if you steal your food. Then, you know, then maybe you can feel guilty because you've stolen it. But otherwise, there is absolutely no reason to beat yourself up and be judgmental about your eating. You're doing the best that you can do. And there are people who have compulsively overeaten, emotionally eaten for years, and they really are battling unhealthy weights. And with those people, it's so important for them to understand that this was a coping mechanism, overeating. It was a coping mechanism to deal with the failure they were feeling about the diets they were on, but it was also a coping mechanism to deal with so many emotional aspects of life where they didn't have tools to deal with them. And so it's about, thank goodness you had your food. Please let go of your guilt. Please let go of any negative feeling. People walk in here with shame and walk out of here without the shame.
That's incredible. This is Karen Motokaitis, and you're listening to How She Really Does It. My guest today is Elise Resch. Is that correct?
Yes.
Oh, yes. And her book is Intuitive Eating, and we've been talking about how to empower yourself with learning to trust yourself. When you tell your clients to go ahead and they can eat whatever they want, mm-hmm. and especially when they have husbands or, you know, partners or friends who go, this is just a scam.
Uh-huh.
What happens with your clients when you do that?
Well, I'm always hopeful that they will talk to their family members about what they're doing, perhaps even have them read the book or listen to the CDs, to have an orientation to this, to understand some of the psychological components of it. And I often have partners come into the office so that I can do some teaching of it, or even do a phone consultation with a parent of a teenager, let's say, so that the person understands. I had one little girl I worked with many years ago whose mother had heard about me through a friend, and she and her husband came in and talked to me first. They were both on diets. They were unwilling to give up diets, but they didn't want to do that to their child. And I explained the whole philosophy to them so that when she first started working with me and the first session she had to ask her parents to bring chocolate in the house, they didn't think that this was crazy, you know. So I'm hopeful that people will educate the people around them. Otherwise, it's very important to just have that voice setting up the boundaries of saying, this is my issue, this is my body, this is my eating, please, no comments. And that's so important because we have a lot of boundary invasion going on, and that's what I was talking about earlier about this autonomy. People's boundaries get invaded by other people telling them what to eat or how much to eat or that they're being, you know, they're overeating. That's enough, honey. You've had enough. You know, that type of thing. It becomes a boundary invasion of that very private inner place, and people end up being very rebellious, even more rebellious than they would be. So sometimes it's just a matter of standing up for oneself. I work with a lot of people with very serious eating disorders, and in the world of eating disorders, we often think that an eating disorder represents a person's inability to stand up for herself and speak up, or she may speak up, she or he, but what's being said isn't heard. And so the eating itself becomes the way that one speaks up for oneself, whether it's someone who's anorexic, very underweight, very sick, you know, look at me, I'm sick, please help me, or overweight and, you know, being able to say, I'm defying you, this is who I'm going to be.
And so when you give your clients that permission to eat whatever they want,
mm-hmm.
do they gain weight at first? What happens?
Well, the interesting thing, something very, very interesting happens. And I see it over and over, and it's wonderful. People go out there, and they, at first, eat more of and more often the foods that they had previously forbidden. And so maybe for a short time, they're starting to feel that they've, you know, puffed out a little bit. But very quickly, they're coming in and telling me, I'm not binging anymore. I'm not overeating anymore. I had, you know, I have French fries or pasta or things that they thought that they shouldn't have, and I didn't even want that much of it. So is there the possibility for a little bit of weight gain in the beginning? Perhaps, but not all the time. So now some of the people that are maybe underweight to begin with and they want to let go of all the rigidity, maybe they need to gain a little weight, and that might happen.
And do you find that when you give them that permission, they eventually settle into that place where they're not in that deprivation mindset?
Very quickly, very quickly. Sometimes after a little while, they start to revert a bit and go back to old thinking, oh, how can I eat this food? I shouldn't be eating this food. And then we have to check in on that and take a look at, have you let go, have you rejected the diet mentality, and do we have to come back around to that beginning place where you make the decision that you'll never diet again? And everything is a process. My work is all a process. It's about helping people move through this in their own ways. So some people are directly, they let go of all the old thoughts, and very quickly they're on the path. And other people, it takes a long time. Sometimes it depends on how long they've been dieting and how entrenched the diet thinking is. Many years ago, I worked with a young woman who had gone on her first diet about a week before she came to see me. So it took about two or three sessions, and she was fine. She was on her way. But, other people have been dieting for years and years and years, and it's a longer process.
And how long is the process for some of your clients?
Again, it's so individual. It depends. How long have they been, doing this? How serious is the disorder? Mm-hmm. Because sometimes, diets, one of the worst outcomes of dieting is a severe eating disorder. So sometimes people have been dieting for years and now have very serious eating disorders. They may have bulimia. They may be binging and purging. They may be have exercise bulimia, where they're mm-hmm. binging and then exercising off the calories, or just so many different aspects of eating disorders. For someone with an eating disorder, it can take 7 years, actually, to heal. But for most of the people who come in who don't have a severe eating disorder, just a bit of disordered eating, which is mm-hmm. different than an eating disorder, depending on how willing they are to surrender to this and let go of the old thinking, it can be a couple of months, it can be a couple of years.
It's interesting because I don't know if this happens with you, but when I do a consult with a potential new client, that they want to know how long is this going to take.
Mm-hmm.
How long, and there's been a lot of conditioning, of course, lose 30 pounds in 30 days or lose 2 pounds a week, and I say the same thing, is that it's a process.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to being a coach, a life coach or weight loss coach, I was an athletic coach. I was a swim coach for mm-hmm. years. And again, it's the same thing of having people really to trust the process and say, look, it's a process. I'm not going to give you a guaranteed outcome, but it's a process, and we're going to get better. You're going to learn how to swim.
Well, and it's about the progress that people make, not mm-hmm. perfection.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a diagram I drew, not great art, but diagram I drew that I call the spiral of healing. And if you imagine a spiral starting at the bottom of the page, spiraling upward, the momentum is always upward. There's always improvement happening, but there's these little curlicues along the way where you kind of have to go back to some old behaviors to see how they work for you and realize that you want to let them go. And
mm-hmm.
But the movement is always upward. And I actually like to think of this in Taoist terms, where and I'm not an expert in Taoism, but that in this process concept, things have to go at the speed that they have to go, and the more you try to control them or push them, the longer it's going to take. So, yes, the key word here is process.
And I love that. When I was reading your book, I was like, oh, the process. I love that instead of focusing on the result, because, and please tell me where I'm wrong, but I feel like our society is so much about the result, the end result.
Well, we want instant gratification. We want it right now. We want to know where we're headed. People don't want to just live life and let it happen and, learn and enjoy as they're going along. They want to know what the end point's going to be. You're right.
And doesn't it come back to that trust again?
Absolutely. Trusting. It's knowing that it's actually a fairly spiritual approach,
uh-huh.
and I don't want to go into that too much, but really knowing that our bodies know. You just need to trust that it's all going to be okay.
And you've had a lot of practice with this, so.
Oh, lots of years. Almost 30 years. So. Long time.
So, speaking of process, one of the questions when I was reading your book I had come up with was, What are the results? Because this will be a question that people, these are questions that people give me for my weight loss coaching, but what are the results of intuitive eating? And what, how do you answer that to
a
client?
That's a wonderful question, Corinne. It's when you're looking at results, you want to be looking more at how does one change one's relationship with food? How are you feeling emotionally? How are you, do you have more peace of mind? Are you happier? I have had people say to me, I actually don't care if I lose an ounce. I just can't live like this anymore. And then, of course, many other people, you know, really are want to or feel that they need to lose some weight. I always like to put weight loss on the back burner, which is something so important, to not focus on the weight loss, but to look at how are you changing the quality of your life? How are you changing the way you're feeling? It actually extends into your relationships with other people, decisions about jobs, many things. How is life better for you? So results are really much more qualitative than they are quantitative. On the other hand, there are people who, I've seen people lose 100 pounds doing this work, but I'm not weighing them. I'm not counting up their calories. Nobody talks in those numbers. It's not about that. It's about, was my eating experience satisfying? Was I using food emotionally? How can I deal with life without food? So it's not, you know, it's not going to be that kind of, yes, I lost 10 pounds and I did a good job. There's a young man I worked with when he was in high school, and he did lose close to 100 pounds when he finally came to understand the emotional component of his eating. And year after year, I see him. He's in the middle of college now, and he comes by and says hi. And the quality of his life is so much better. He started working out. He had never worked out because he had been overweight all of his childhood and felt bad about himself. And now he's healthier, and he's more social. And so is the result the fact that he lost the weight? Not in my mind. The result is that he's living his life in a healthier and more satisfying way. So I don't like the idea of weight loss. I know it's going to go against what you're saying in terms of the work that you do, but I don't like to focus on weight loss. I never talk about this as work around weight. I talk about it as work around changing one's relationship with food and body.
Oh, no, and I so believe that. And last January or December, was it, somebody had called me and they were like, well, what are the results? What's the percentage of people that lose weight? What are the percentage of people that don't? And what are the statistics? And how does this work? And this is a person that, again, is one of the people that look really good on the outside, but is white knuckling it every single day.
Right.
And this person looks like they have it together. They exercise, they eat really well, but every day it is a white knuckle. And that was when I just said, I didn't know if that this process would be for them, because it's about changing. Cause my work is about changing a relationship with food so that you can go and live your life and enjoy the other aspects of it.
And it's also, I mean, I know you work in the world of movement. It's also changing your relationship with I like to call exercise movement, because we kind of all need to move, and exercise starts to sound like it's a chore rather than something enjoyable. And it's looking at, how can movement be a part of my life so I feel better, so I'm more awake? I was telling you earlier that I exercised a little or moved a little bit this morning just to wake up, to be alert for what we were going to do today. Am I strong? Am I feeling, you know, full of vitality? It's a whole different approach to it than, am I exercising to lose weight? And in fact, there's so much exercise resistance out there because people think they're exercising for the purpose of losing weight. And it's actually pretty hard to lose weight just simply by exercising. You really need to be intuitive in eating as well.
So. Well, and I always think of every January when everybody joins the gyms. And it's really hard to get a spot on a machine or in the weight room. And because everybody has these good intentions. And then, you know, pretty quickly by February, you know that you're going to have more space.
And what's really interesting about that, too, is that some people who are dedicated to going to a gym, they don't move any other time in their life. So you can go to a shopping mall and you can see the stairs. There's one nearby where I live, and there's stairs in between the two escalators. And the escalators are jammed, you know, you're waiting to get up to the next level, and the stairs are empty. So people say, well, I exercise, I go to the gym, but they're not moving the rest of the time. So movement encompasses daily activity as well. And sometimes they find that people are healthier when they're just parking a little further and walking, walking a distance or taking stairs.
Now, at this old health club that I belonged at, it only had maybe 20 spots, and you'd have to park further out. And people would circle and circle and sit for, 10 to 15 minutes to wait for a parking space right by the gym doors.
Pretty funny, huh?
It is funny, how we conditioned ourselves. And it's like, exercise only counts if I'm on that machine and it says I've spit out these many calories.
And then a lot of people who are feeling uncomfortable with their bodies don't want to go to the gym because they don't want to compare themselves to others, look in the mirror. And so they have this, exercise resistance, and they'll say, well, why should I bother walking? It's not going to make any difference. If I don't go to the gym, I'm not going to, it doesn't matter. And then they just are completely sedentary. So it's unfortunate, our whole national relationship with exercise.
Well, and so do people come to you with this idea that, okay, if I eat intuitively, I'm going to be able to, and you're down in Southern California.
Right.
So I'm going to be able to look like this picture, this image.
Well, it's unfortunately a lot of the teenagers do.
Mm-hmm.
They don't understand the level of digital altering and, airbrushing and, things that are done to make people look a certain way in magazines. And they also don't understand that so many of the young women on television shows are actually anorexic, or if not anorexic, they are smoking and sometimes using drugs and doing things that are not so healthy for them to stay as thin as they are. So the young ones need to be educated. Some of the older people who are a little more with what's going on realize that that's just an image that most people are not going to attain.
And is that just going to continue on as the media standard?
Let's hope not. There are some, there are some strides. There was a television show last summer about a weight loss camp that was actually quite psychological. And there's, I know that there's a sitcom on now about a couple who've met in Overeaters Anonymous. Of course, then there's all the horrible weight loss shows, which I think are the worst. I think actually those are detriment to the cause. But we're hoping to get it out there as much as we can.
Can you say more about that? Because I know I have my feelings. We don't have to name any shows, but I know I have my feelings about some of those shows, and I don't watch a whole lot.
Criminal, really. They're criminal. The participants are put under extreme conditions that are very unhealthy to the body. The amount of output and the small amount of input in terms of food and the psychological damage that's done. Actually, there was a former client I had heard about, a young girl who went on one of these, and I won't name it, one of the shows for teenagers, and lost an enormous amount of weight and no psychological support, and she ended up seriously bulimic afterwards. I think they're very dangerous, and I think they make people feel very bad about themselves and demoralized, and people in the audience and people on the shows who can't quite make it. And you can't keep that up in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
It's inevitable that
mm-hmm.
weight's going to come back on. And in fact, after diets, a lot of the reason that people gain a lot of weight back and more weight is that, first of all, they're coming from a slowed metabolism from having taken in too little food. But also, once they break the diet, once they start to see that the weight comes on just naturally because they've been, under eating, they just kind of throw in the towel and say, I can't do it. It's worthless. And then they go beyond and beyond and really overeat.
I appreciate you saying that. I know that one of the reasons I do this show is because, and one of the reasons it's an hour is to get beyond the sound bites,
mm-hmm.
right? And also when I deal with entrepreneurs or people who've done well in their life and achieved a certain level of success is that we talk about how long their overnight success actually took, 12 years.
Right.
And that's why I was kind of, trying to, asking you the question of like, okay, if people go through this process, how long? And the fact that it's a process, if
mm-hmm.
people can understand, because like you said earlier, we're in the state of instant gratification. in the media, like having these shows where we may watch something, I don't know if it's 8 weeks or 12 weeks long, and their process is an 8 month process, and they're losing, you know, a huge amount of weight, what, 150 pounds,
mm-hmm.
right? People think, well, then I should do that. And then that becomes the next weapon to beat themselves up.
Absolutely.
That they're not doing it.
So I'm not a fan of those shows. I ban them. I don't watch them.
So, and I appreciate you, you know, going and talking about that a bit, because it is, I mean, if people can take away anything from my show, is that whatever possibility that they're trying to attain, is that it's a process. And the reason that I so loved your work is that it's a trial and error. It's not even an error. It's about, okay, how is this working, and how is this working, and does that feel right, and how do I feel, and constantly using yourself as the guidance.
Well, and I love that you said there is no error. One of the things that I like to tell my clients is that there are no mistakes here, that mm-hmm. everything that you do is an opportunity to learn, to see how it works for you, and is there a different way that it can work for you that feels, you know, feels better. And I also love to tell people, please come from a place of curiosity, not judgment. So whatever happened, be curious about it. You know, it's like, oh, that's interesting. I ended up eating that whole, you know, that whole plate of food, and I was stuffed afterwards. Oh, I get it. I was on the computer while I was doing that. I need to pay attention a little more when I'm eating. Versus, I can't believe I ate all that food, and, you know, now I'm feeling stuffed.
Yeah. No, the reason I laughed was that I use that opportunity to learn quite a bit with my clients.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, I understand that sometimes we just don't want any more opportunities to learn.
Right. But little by little, they build on each other, and eventually you see major change.
And that's the thing. It's those little steps that do make those big changes. A lot of times, and I think this is the misconception, and again, it goes to that all or nothing mentality of you must take these huge leaps. They've got to be gigantic leaps. Like, mm-hmm. I have to clean up all of my eating today because Thanksgiving's coming in 2 weeks.
Now, the only leap is the leap of faith into this whole philosophy of rejecting dieting and really starting to learn how to hear your body signals, your hunger, your fullness, your taste preference, how you feel after you've eaten. That's the big leap. It's that leap of faith. Once you take that leap, everything else is tiny baby steps.
This is Elise Resch.
Resch,
co-author of Intuitive Eating. And so that sounds like that would be one of the takeaways for the listeners today.
Yes, I would say that that would be one. I think another one would be put weight loss on the back burner. I mean, just, I have this image of this big Viking stove with all of these, you know, places to put to put things, and the weight loss is way in the back. Because if you focus on the weight loss, then really it's going to sabotage the judgments that you're making in terms of listening to your body. And then the third thing would be, a third takeaway that I think would be most important, is be present. Be present for your life in general, mm-hmm. but be present when you're eating. Appreciate the opportunity to enjoy your food and feel satisfied. Eat when you're in a space that is, you know, going to be the most optimal way for you to eat, not on the computer, not necessarily in front of the television. I'm not someone who says don't do anything when you're eating, because, you know, I like to read a magazine sometimes when I'm eating, but certainly to be able to stay focused with, you know, with your eating experience. And most people are not present. They're going through life without, you know, without really focusing.
It's like the popcorn at the end of the at the end of the box when you're watching a movie, and you're like, but wait, where'd all the popcorn go?
Well, you don't notice it at all, and you really didn't enjoy it that much.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, so those would be the things.
And what do you say to a client who says, you know, I just don't have time. I just don't have time to eat.
Don't have time to eat. Oh, okay. Well, that's a choice that one makes, a prioritizing, you know, choice. And actually, if you have to, eat it in the car. Now, I know you're going to find other authors or people saying, don't ever eat in the car. But if there's no other choice, if your child's getting up at 7:45 and has to be at school at 8, so he's going to eat his peanut butter toast in the car on the way to school, you know, at mm-hmm. least get the food in.
Well, my comments always, I mean, really, do we not have, I mean, how long does it really take us to eat? 5 minutes, 7 minutes, maybe 10 minutes? I mean,
well,
it's, you know, depending.
And again, it's prioritizing, and it's whether you're fueling yourself or whether you're really going to sit down and really enjoy and be satisfied. Sometimes we just have to have food for fuel just to get going. And that's going to be a different situation than sitting down and relaxing and enjoying your meal. But in any case, just notice that you're eating it. Notice what it tastes like. Enjoy it. Feel grateful for it.
And so when you say, because I know Jeanine Roth has her rules of, you know, you just eat, you don't do anything else, and no watching TV or reading. So you do say you can go ahead and read and eat.
I'm not an absolutist in any way. So I don't think in black and white terms. I think that one has to find the way that's going to work for that person. And if somebody takes away my newspaper in the morning when I'm eating my breakfast, I'm going to be very angry. But I can fully pay attention to my breakfast while I'm eating the paper. For some people, if they really cannot do that, then they might have to be able to just sit and eat. But no, I think there are certainly ways in which you can do other things as well. But some of them are consuming. Like, I think the computer is really a difficult one because you really can't pay attention to the food. When you're reading a newspaper, you can look at your food and take a bite and then go back to the newspaper.
Uh-huh.
Television can be dangerous if you are, you know, totally sucked into the program and you have a big bag of potato chips. You might find that they're gone, or, as you said, the popcorn at the movies. So, but it's not all or nothing. It's what works for you. I don't like rules. I really don't. And this whole philosophy, all of intuitive eating, it's not about rules. And I will say this, that some people try to turn it into another diet. And they start feeling guilty if they eat something when they're not hungry. Or, no, these are guidelines. This is just a guideline for the best relationship with food, for the most satisfying experience with eating. But there's no rules. So that's going to be different than, you know, what some others might think.
Well, Elise, I really want to thank you for being a guest today.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope some people find some things.
There we go. This is Corinne Motokaitis, and you've been listening to How She Really Does It. My guest today is Elise Resch, and she's the co-author of Intuitive Eating.
Early morning, fog is lifting, she's in a robe.